Jonathan Sumption, Lord Sumption, isn't afraid of hard work or an intellectual challenge. He's combined a high-profile legal career with a passion for medieval history, and his books include a five-volume, 4,000-page account of the 100 Years' War, widely described as monumental. For much of his career, he was a very successful barrister, working on commercial law, constitutional law, and human rights cases, with clients ranging from the British government to Roman Abramovich. Then, in 2012, he made history when he was appointed to the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, without ever having served as a full-time judge. In 2019, he gave the Reith Lectures under the title Law and the Decline of Politics, examining how the courts are taking on more of the role of making law. It's a topic he follows up in his most recent book, The Challenges of Democracy and the Rule of Law. Jonathan, music by Britten, Berlioz, Schumann and Mozart you've brought us today, but we're going to begin with Nikolaus Bruns.
Well, it's one of the first really notable musical experiences of my life. As a teenager, when I visited Paris for the first time, I wandered into the Church of Saint-Eustache by Les Halles. There was a very grand funeral in progress, you know, complete with orchestra, organ, uniformed flunkies, open coffin, the works. And this piece was played on what must be one of the most powerful organs in the world, built by the great English organ builder Charles Barker. And although it seems odd to translate music from a funeral to a wedding, that was the music that I wanted at my wedding. I have to say that the Church of St. John's Boulder in Hampshire doesn't have an organ of quite the power of Saint-Eustache in Paris, but it still sounded pretty good.
So we'll hear it performed on the organ in the St. Patrikirche, Mella, Germany, built in 1724 by Christian Vater.
Thank you.
It's almost orchestral in its texture, isn't it?
Well, especially played on an organ which I'm told has 8,000 pipes, but it's a terrific piece.
And I have to ask you, did it all go well for your nuptials and what followed?
I'm still married to her.
Excellent. Now, most listeners, when we say we're going to hear a prelude and fugue for organ, would think we're going to hear Johann Sebastian Bach, but that was the prelude and fugue for organ in E minor by Nikolaus Bruns, performed by Friedhelm Flammer. You would not go for a piece of Bach, would you, Jonathan?
No. This is the fastest way to be branded as a Philistine that I know, but I don't like Bach. I mean, one can give all sorts of reasons, but the best reason came when you had on your programme my old boss, Brenda Hale, who does like Bach, and when explaining why, she said, he's a lawyer's composer. And I said, yeah, that's it. That's the reason I don't like Bach. Not enough emotion. Too logical.
Tell me a little bit about your early life. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in London with parents who were interested in music but had a very narrow repertoire, Mozart, Beethoven and Verdi.
You were the eldest of four?
I was the eldest of four children, yes. Mm.
And your father had been a naval officer in the war?
Yes, he was a naval officer in the war. He was, I think, 19 when the war broke out. He immediately joined the armed forces and served in submarines.
And your mother also had to falsify some papers to take part?
Yes, my mother was born in Ireland, and she wanted to escape. So the moment the war broke out, she came over to England and joined the Navy. And it was really the making of her, because by the end of the war, she was running the British Forces post office in the Middle East, based first at Alexandria, then at Cairo, and finally at Gibraltar, where she met my father. We still have a photograph of her holding a clipboard in the middle of a baking hot courtyard with lots of ratings carrying heavy mail bags all around her. Very evocative photo.
And was it a happy childhood, would you say?
Yes.
And were there any instruments in the house?
Yes, there was always a piano.
Which you played?
Well, truer to say that my wife and later my children played it. I did learn the piano up to the age of 16. I gave it up, and then when I tried to recover my piano playing in my 40s, it simply didn't work. So it's a warning, nobody should ever give up the piano, however much they hate their piano teacher.
And how soon did you branch out from Mozart, Beethoven and Verdi?
Well, I got married very young, and my wife and I used to go every Saturday morning to a cafe in Soho, and afterwards to a very old-fashioned music shop called Handmade Gramophones in Soho Square. And this was one of those wonderful old-fashioned shops where you could actually leaf through hundreds and hundreds of physical recordings. In those days it was LPs. I used to buy one LP a week, and that was the basis of my musical education for quite a few years.
It's a piano quartet next, which is why I asked whether you played possibly this at any point.
No. Oh, I've certainly played it. I'm an outstanding performer on the gramophone. I play the gramophone very well indeed. And that's how I learnt first about this piece. Actually, I was reminded of it because we have two-thirds of a piano trio living in our house, and have had for a number of years, and they were rehearsing this the whole of this week. So it reminded me quite what a beautiful piece of chamber music. I think one of the most beautiful pieces of chamber music I know this is.
the Jerusalem Quartet, playing Schumann's Piano Quartet in E-flat, with Alexander Melnikov playing the piano. So tell me a little bit more about the group of players that you have in the house. I mean, are they professional musicians?
Yes. The trio is called the Waldstein Trio. Oh. They've been living with us since they were students at Trinity-Laban, which is just down the road from where I live, and arrived in our house more or less by accident, and have never left, and frankly, I'd be delighted if they never did. We have endless concerts. They rehearse in our back hall with the pianist who comes from nearby, and sometimes with additional chamber musicians, so that on a normal day, the house is full of live music. I mean, you can't live more happily than that.
Do you ever request a piece?
Very occasionally. But, you know, they're usually rehearsing for a public concert. They've done very well lately with performances at the Musikverein in Vienna, the Carnegie Hall. They're really getting somewhere.
You went to Eton, Jonathan Sumption. Were you academic?
I was eventually. When I started out at Eton, I was really no good at anything. And I decided it was important to become good at least at something. It clearly wasn't going to be sport, which I found very dull. So it had to be work. So I put my back into becoming academic, and that's a habit that really never left me.
You went to Magdalen College, Oxford,
yes.
And there you studied medieval history.
Yes, because it was the only thing left after school when I had been very thoroughly taught English history from the Tudors to the 20th century and quite a lot of European history. And I didn't want to go through all that again, so I did the period earlier that I didn't know about.
And then you became a tutor, publishing
yes.
a book on pilgrimages in the Middle Ages in 1974.
Yes, I spent 4 years as a junior research fellow at Magdalen College, Oxford, but I had a full ration of teaching as well. And then I left in 1975 in order to become a barrister, but I never stopped being an academic historian, really. I continued to write books throughout my time, both as a barrister and as a judge. I couldn't have done without it. I think if you do two things and try and do them well, you're likely to do them better than if you just did one. So Oxford was really a very formative period in my life.
And formative in terms of music, because it was at Oxford that you were first introduced to Berlioz.
Yes. Well, I had a friend who has had a lifetime obsession with Berlioz. I'm profoundly grateful to him because I'm not sure that I would have otherwise appreciated quite what an extraordinary musician Berlioz was, arguably the greatest orchestrator of the 19th century, yet a composer who hardly ever heard his own music, since he was unfashionable, didn't teach at the conservatoire, which rather disapproved of him, and therefore didn't have an orchestra to try out his works with. I think I'm right in saying that he never in his lifetime heard Les Troyens, his greatest opera, except for a reduced performance of just the first act. It's a tragic fate. I have heard Les Troyens probably 3 or 4 times as often as he did.
What have you chosen from it?
Nabal's Air from Act 4 of Les Troyens. It's the air in which Nabal warns the Trojans they are in for trouble unless they fulfil the prophecy that they are going to migrate to Italy. Nabal's music, there's not very much of it in the opera, but what there is very noble, and this is one of the great bass arias of the operatic repertoire.
Thank you.
That was the LSO conducted by Colin Davis. He was the man who really put Berlioz on the musical map, and his concert performances at the Barbican of this opera were among the most memorable musical occasions.
We heard Nabal's Air from Act 4 of Les Troyens, performed by Stephen Milling and Sarah Mingardo, with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Colin Davis. Jonathan Sumption, what made you ditch academic life in favour of the bar?
You know, the honest answer to that is that it was the money. I know that's not the right thing to say, but it's the truth. I would like to be able to say that it was a thirst for justice in an imperfect world, but I'm afraid that would not be an honest answer to your question. I found plenty of better reasons after starting, but that was the one that pushed me there. I wasn't taken entirely seriously because I'd been a history don, and people therefore felt that I was a bit of a gadfly and was only doing this as a hobby. I remember my first pupil master, I overheard him saying to my wife at dinner, "Tell me, what does Jonathan intend to do when he's finished his pupilage?" I have to say my heart sank at that point, because my expectation was that I would practice in his chambers. In the end, I practiced in other very good chambers.
You joined Brick Court?
I did. It was an expanding and rising set of chambers.
Including a rather formidable, all-important head clerk.
Yes, the head clerk was a man called Ronald Burley. He was a man of very formidable and hierarchical instincts. He once told me that the first lesson that he'd had, how to be a clerk, came from a very experienced clerk called Matthews, who said, "You've got to know how to address people. You just listen to what I call them. If I call him Jim, you call him Mr. Smith. If I call him Mr. Smith, you call him Sir. And if I call him Sir, you don't speak to him at all."
You're making it sound a little bit like John Mortimer.
Well, John Mortimer wrote from experience, and a lot of what he said was true of the bar up to the big cultural changes that hit the bar in the 70s and 80s. And in a sense, Ronald Burley was a leftover from an earlier period, but he was a very shrewd man, and he really created the chambers. He basically froze out practitioners that he didn't think were good enough and invited in other practitioners that he thought would do the chambers well.
I believe Mr. Burley was not a fan of your raincoat.
It was a Czech raincoat, which I was rather proud of, but which he thought was quite unfitting for a gentleman who aspired to be a barrister. So one day, when I was in court, he took it from my room and burnt it in the courtyard outside. I have to say that my wife thought that this was one of the best things that he ever did, because she hated the raincoat almost as much as he did.
The bonfire of the vanities.
Yes.
What would you say are the most significant changes that have happened in the bar since you joined?
It's become a lot more businesslike, a lot more efficient, a good deal less pompous. The whole process of arguing cases has been condensed. Cases that in the 70s might have taken a week to argue are now polished off in a day or a day and a half. It's a much more disciplined profession than it was in that sense. And I think for that reason, a much more interesting one and a much more taxing one. You actually need to think faster now than you used to. But it's thrilling. It's where the magic is.
You started doing commercial law and by 1986 had become a Queen's Counsel. What was it about the work that you really enjoyed most of all?
The main thing about practising at the bar, particularly if you're an advocate rather than a specialist in written opinions, is the sense of personal responsibility. You're very exposed when you stand up there arguing cases. The preparation may be a team effort, but the actual presentation of a case is quite a solitary business. Arguing an intellectual proposition under ground rules that prevent evasion and doing it before highly intelligent judges, that is a discipline that very few of us, not at the bar, actually get used to. We all have arguments over dinner in which, I'm afraid to say, even the most disciplined of us can be known to cheat. But you can't cheat in court.
And did you enjoy the theatre of it?
Yes, it's a histrionic profession. You need a good cultural hinterland. It's no good just being knowledgeable of the law. You've got to sound interesting. There's a place for humour, not shaggy dog stories, but a humorous turn of phrase. Yes, and an unexpected turn of phrase. I used to say, when people asked what's the single most important lesson about advocacy, the important thing is that when you start a sentence, nobody should be quite sure how it's going to end. That way they pay attention.
And does music offer a way of relaxing for you, or maybe it actually is too stimulating to relax to?
I think it is too stimulating to relax to. At least the sort of music that I like needs to be listened to intently. I find it actually quite difficult to read a book, an activity I very much enjoy, while listening to music, unless it's ballet music.
What music have you chosen next?
The fourth movement of Schubert's Ninth Symphony in C, The Great, which is one of the most rousing and splendid pieces of orchestral music by that great and short-lived composer.
Thank you. The fourth movement from Schubert's Symphony No. 9 in C, The Great, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by George Scholte. Jonathan Sumption, you've advised the government on numerous occasions. Most memorably, you were Alistair Campbell's brief during the 2003 Hutton inquiry into the death of David Kelly. A call, I think, came from number 10 when you were on holiday. How did you feel about being at the heart of a sort of political and media storm?
Well, I've done a number of cases, loosely described as scandal cases, for the government. Obviously, it's extremely interesting being on the inside of cases that are in the news, an educational experience, because you learn how little that you read in the newspapers is either true or complete.
And did you come away from that feeling you'd learnt anything, insights into politics and power?
Well, I think what I mainly learnt is that it can sometimes be useful to have lost just one or two points. Because the government came out with a complete clean bill of health from Hutton's report, I think people didn't take the answer wholly seriously. And I was told by a senior civil servant's office, couldn't you contrive to just lose on a few points but win on the main ones? And unfortunately, I think I know how to win cases. I think I know how to lose them. But I don't know how to lose them by precisely the right amount.
One of your biggest final cases as a silk was between the oligarchs Boris Berezovsky and Roman Abramovich. Berezovsky claimed that he had been intimidated to sell his shares in the Russian oil group Sibneft in the 1980s. Boris was confident he could win. How did you convince the judge otherwise?
Well, it was a case with no law in it at all. It was basically a swearing match between two men about what had happened at meetings at which no one else was present and no written record was made. So it was quite challenging. I mean, I cross-examined Boris Berezovsky for 9 days, and I think probably most of those in court felt that at the end of that process there wasn't much left of Berezovsky's case. I mean, I don't necessarily claim the credit for that. I think that it's essentially the result of the way that Boris Berezovsky chose to give evidence.
Well, it clearly worked because Mrs. Justice Gloucester called Berezovsky dishonest and deluded.
Well, that's very flattering, and I suppose I'm most grateful to her. Although since I left the bar immediately after that, it wouldn't have done me any professional good.
One of the most sublime pieces of Mozart next.
Yes. Suave Ciel Vento. I have a particular affection for this extremely beautiful piece of music, because in 2000, Teresa and I started a very small opera festival in the courtyard of our house in France. At the time, I was a trustee of the Royal Academy of Music. I've always been interested in musical training, and this was an opportunity for people who were either at conservatoire or had just left to put something on their CV that they wouldn't have got at their age from a serious opera house. I wouldn't claim that we were a serious opera house, but we did give people an opportunity to perform demanding pieces with a full orchestra and chorus. They have included some very fine performers, Louise Alder, Nicky Spence, Sam Furness, all trod the boards for the first time in our courtyard.
This particular piece, Suave Ciel Vento, May the Wind Be Gentle, from Act One of Mozart's Così.
That was the first opera that we put on in 2000 itself. It's a particularly magical piece in which the women whose husbands have just gone off to war are hoping that they have a smooth journey to the front.
And Mozart conjures up the lapping of waves absolutely brilliantly.
Yes, he does. It is a quite extraordinary piece in that sense. But it also, of course, owes a great deal to the librettist Da Ponte.
Thank you. Suave sil vento, may the wind be gentle, from Act One of Mozart's Così fan tutte, performed by the soprano Sandrine Piau, the mezzo-soprano Léa de Sandre, and the baritone Florian Sempe, with the Insular Orchestra, conducted by Laurence Equilbet. In 2012, Jonathan Sumption, you became a Justice of the Supreme Court. The first time anyone, as I said earlier, had been elected from the bar without serving full-time as a judge. So did it surprise you?
Well, it would have surprised me if you'd told me a few years earlier, because the practice had been invariably to appoint to the highest court from the ranks of existing judges. But I was told they were contemplating opening it up a bit by advertising. And indeed I was asked, before they did that, whether I was likely to apply, which I took as a hint, although I know that the same question was asked of at least one other member of the bar. It was, I think, in the view of many of my contemporaries, a surprising thing, and in the view of some of them, a most disagreeable one.
You had worked part-time.
Oh, yes. I was a recorder here in criminal cases in London for some 12 years, and I had also sat on the part-time Court of Appeal in the Channel Islands.
Can you explain how judges in the Supreme Court come to a decision? Does it have to be unanimous?
No. The Supreme Court, like the House of Lords Judicial Committee before it, sits normally in panels of five, although there can be more. And it's essentially a majority. We listen to the arguments. We meet beforehand quite briefly in order to exchange very provisional views. But that very often changes in the course of argument. We then have a much longer meeting. Each member of the court, from the most junior upwards, gives in turn a short sort of 5-minute mini judgment. And at the end of that, the presiding judge will decide what the majority is and who's going to write the judgment. But anybody can write a judgment. You can write a concurring judgment. You can write a dissenting judgment. Indeed, it's not unheard of for the dissenting judgment to become the majority if the rest are sufficiently persuaded. But it is a very collaborative process. You know, we don't go into our caves and come out with tablets proclaiming our view, and that's cut and dried. We exchange drafts. There's a certain amount of negotiation. And for that reason, the Supreme Court is the one court that can overrule any earlier decision, including a decision of its own. It's at that level where you are deciding legal policy at its most fundamental and significant.
More piano music next.
Yes, I am very fond of Wagner's operas. I thought I would kill two birds with one stone and have one of Liszt's piano transcriptions of Wagner. These are actually works in their own right. They're not just transcriptions. They are quite remarkable essays in conveying some of the richness of orchestral music in a piano. Thank you.
Overture to Wagner's Tannhäuser, as arranged brilliantly by Liszt and performed by Tanguy de Villancourt. It's an extraordinary act of creation on Liszt's part, isn't it,
yes,
as you were saying?
Because it conveys not just the tune, but the texture. I mean, that's one reason why I think the best piano performances do not observe the very slow tempo of the orchestral original. The thing about the piano is that the music's got holes in it, so to speak. They're not continuous the way that string instruments convey. And I think, therefore, you need to play these pieces faster than an orchestra would perform them. But they're all very impressive pieces.
Alongside your legal work, Jonathan Sumption, you've written a five-part history of the Hundred Years' War. The first volume came out in 1990, the final part in 2023. What was it that drew you to study that conflict between England and France during the late Middle Ages?
I have always been interested in the history of war. That sounds rather grim. It's not the violence that attracts me. What interests me about war is that apart from organized religion, it has, for most of human history, been the chief collective activity of mankind. It taxes human societies. It lies at the origin of the state. It's an extraordinarily fertile process. You could say that the Napoleonic Wars and the two world wars of the 20th century transformed the British state and many other states. The Hundred Years' War did something rather similar to the late Middle Ages. It took 43 years of my life. My contract said it was going to take 15, but I'm afraid that didn't work out.
Has that informed your view of what's going on in the world today?
To some extent, yes. I mean, we are better at avoiding wars than our ancestors were. But we still find ourselves trapped in a situation where people can't back down. That was very much a feature of the Hundred Years' War. Even when the English knew that they were going to lose, they couldn't lose face, they couldn't admit that they'd always been wrong, which would have been the lesson that people would draw if they compromised. And of course, we are witnessing exactly the same thing in Ukraine at the moment, as we have in so many wars over the last two centuries.
You must have done a huge amount of meticulous research in French as well as English archives.
Well, I think it's probably the last major episode in history where a single person can reasonably hope to read everything that survives. That, of course, is partly because so much doesn't survive, and the gaps are themselves part of the pleasure. I would not like to write a history of something where everything was knowable. There's got to be some scope for historical imagination.
I think you got quite a bit of pleasure from the sheer tactile experience.
Oh, yes. I mean, in the Public Record Office in Kew Gardens, you can actually hold in your hand the book which the person whose duty it was to do the rounds on the walls of Calais held going about his job. You can read notes at the end of rather dull books of accounts, revealing but dull, in which the scribe then suddenly says, "I can't do any more today, it's too perishing cold in this tent." I mean, that has an immediacy which few other things can convey.
Your next choice relates to the Hundred Years' War.
Yes. John Dunstable was a 15th century composer who was a great master of the English polyphonic music style. And he had a significant role in the war, not that he fought in it, unlike, for example, Chaucer, who did actually fight. But Dunstable produced the music that seems to have been performed at the marriage of Henry V and Catherine de Valois in 1420, which sealed the Treaty of Troyes, the treaty by which France subordinated itself to the English monarchy. And the music was almost certainly performed again when Henry VI was crowned as a child in Notre Dame Cathedral, a monumentally tactless occasion in which the English ran the whole show, insisting on music from the Chapel Royal, as a result of which there was actually a fight that broke out with the canons of Notre Dame, who thought that this was a thoroughly bad show.
Another war. So it's the Sanctus that we're going to hear.
Yes, from one of Dunstable's masses.
Thank you.
wonderfully atmospheric music. You yes. can't help feeling that if they'd just listened to it, they wouldn't have wanted to fight.
Yes. These medieval pieces were beautifully adapted to the acoustic of the immense stone buildings in which they were performed. The concert hall of today just can't reproduce it.
The Sanctus by John Dunstable, performed by the Bachois Consort, conducted by Andrew Kirkman. In 2019, Jonathan Sumption, you delivered the Wreath Lectures, in which you argued that the laws is an expanding empire taking over the space once occupied by politics. And I wonder why you felt that has happened, and actually developed this in your book, The Challenges of Democracy and the Rule of Law.
I felt that one of the problems of the democratic state, which has quite a short history, 150 years or so in this country, is that people's expectations of the state and of government mount, and they end up expecting things of the state which the state can't produce. So people look for alternative ways of getting their own way. One of them, of course, is law. Law was, for most of my legal career, an alternative to politics, which too many judges, in my view, were too willing to indulge. It seemed to me that this was an invasion of the sphere of politics. People despise politics, but the truth is that we can't have democracy without politics, and we can't have politics without politicians. And they're not as corrupt or self-interested as they're often portrayed. They are, on the whole, public-spirited people who are trying to do their best in what is very often an impossible situation.
You noticed a trend over the last 30 years of people in the UK turning against democracy.
Yes. This is very much a problem at the moment. Polling evidence is fairly consistent in showing that people find the frustrations of democracy intolerable. Of course, it is frustrating because you can't always get your own way, but it looks as if a very high proportion of the British public think that a strong man would be a better solution.
Is democracy being threatened with being abolished, or is it just being redefined?
What it's threatened with is a very gradual and often imperceptible process by which everything that once made the system democratic is gradually poured out of the bottle. So you get left with the bottle and the label, but there's nothing inside it. The world is full of countries which were once democracies, but have gradually been suborned by ambitious individuals. It's happened in Chavez's Venezuela. It happened in Viktor Orban's Hungary. It happened in Erdogan's Turkey. And I'm afraid it is happening now in the United States.
I'm fascinated, given your experience, to know what you make of what's happening in the United States. For example, does the Supreme Court have any power to veto Donald Trump's decisions?
Well, it has power to say that he's acting unconstitutionally. It has power to say that he must do something different. The problem is that last year the Supreme Court held that he was immune from criminal proceedings for acts done as president. And the only way, ultimately, that a court can enforce its orders is by criminal sanctions for contempt of court. So what the Supreme Court has done is they've handed Trump what, for practical purposes, amounts to a license to ignore the courts. And he has already started, when he loses a case, engaging in foul-mouthed abuse of the judge, threatening him with impeachment, which is an absurd threat. You can't impeach judges for the way they decide cases. And this is, I think, a profoundly damaging situation. What causes me concern is that there are a lot of people in this country who would like to see someone like Trump in charge here. And they have a significant body of support if the polls are right. So that the crisis of expectations, which has produced the cultural collapse of American democracy, is something that might happen here. After all, European expectations of the state are probably even higher than American ones.
Do you think it could happen here?
I think it could. In some ways, the constitutional settlement that we have in this country is more resilient than the American one. A parliamentary system is better at dispersing power than a presidential system. And therefore, if you were going to have a hooligan prime minister, he would need to carry a lot more people with him than is the case in the United States. It's also the case that judges in Britain are not appointed by politicians. That's only been the case for the last 20 years. But it's a very important difference. The way in which Trump has packed the federal judiciary in the United States would be very difficult to achieve here.
We were talking earlier, Jonathan Sumption, about what Colin Davis did for Berlioz, and now we could talk about what Charles Mackerras has done for Janáček.
Yes, it's remarkable. He has essentially put Janáček on the map, not just as a conductor, but as the editor of Janáček's scores. It's a remarkable personal achievement by a very great musician. I've chosen a beautiful piece from Janáček's opera Yennefer, which is about infanticide. It's an emotionally searing opera. It's about love and about murder. To my mind, one of the greatest operas ever written. This is Yennefer praying for her infant child, unaware that the child had already been murdered by her mother.
Yennefer's prayer from Act 2 of Janáček's opera Yennefer, performed by Elizabeth Söderström and the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Charles Mackerras. Jonathan Sumption, you stood down from the Supreme Court of the UK in 2018 when you turned 70, and then sat as a judge in the Hong Kong Court of Final Appeal for 5 years. What was that like? What was that court like?
It's a distinguished court. I was proud to sit on the court. The problems began to arise the year after my appointment with the national security law, which was imposed on Hong Kong by the Beijing government. And that eventually led me to resign from the court. because I lost confidence in the ability of the Hong Kong courts to stand up to the pressure from China to convict individuals who had taken a political stance that China disapproved of. I hung on for as long as I felt I could, simply because the national security law has savings for civil rights, and there was therefore plenty of opportunity for the Hong Kong courts to rescue something of the traditional impartiality of the common law and its traditional defence of the rights of criminal defendants. I was sorry to have to leave the court. I have lost friends that I valued. But there comes a point where you simply can't go on with a system that you disapprove of.
Music by Benjamin Britten next. One of the four sea interludes from Peter Grimes. What inspired this choice?
Well, again, I think that the orchestration is extraordinarily inventive. And as an atmosphere creator, they are really unequalled.
Dawn from Britten's 4C Interludes from Peter Grimes, performed by the Bergen Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Namer Yervi. Jonathan, now that you've finished with the Hundred Years' War, do you have plans to write about any other historical period?
Well, I'm currently writing about the French Wars of Religion, the last occasion in European history when Europeans massacred each other for purely religious reasons. I think an object lesson for our times.
Well, before we release you from court, Jonathan, I have to ask you one final question. Since you dissed Bach so totally at the opening of the programme, I want to know whether, for example, Erbarmadik from the Matthew Passion leaves you completely cold?
No, not completely. It's true that the temptation to exaggerate is strong.
You are absolved. Tell me about the final piece you've chosen.
This is the Moonlight Music at the beginning of the final act of Richard Strauss's opera Capriccio. It's a most extraordinarily atmospheric and autumnal piece of music. And it's autumnal in several senses. It was the autumn of Strauss's own life. It was one of the very last things that he composed. It was the last opera that he composed.
And indeed the autumn of the world he was looking at.
Indeed.
The bombing of Dresden, all of these things.
Yes.
Well, Jonathan Sumption, thank you so much.
It's been very interesting choosing pieces. One has to reject so many. I've enjoyed the ones I've listened to there.